All action arises from the volition of the will and is directed by thought and emotion. Thus, it becomes obvious that our activity patterns arise in ourselves, and the importance of the integration of these patterns is obvious in all of our daily relationships with other people. It becomes evident that the individual with a purposed life must have a purposeful pattern. If there is no integration or organization within the individual, there can be no true continuity of action, and the person is subject to self-contradictions. Also, lack of insight as to purpose or meaning destroys the validity of any single action that may be performed. Without purpose, the individual lives by a series of incidental circumstances. His conclusion at any one moment may be valid or not valid, but it lacks relationship. It lacks dependency upon previous decision. And most of all, it fails to reveal any broad, general purpose. Today in our Western life, we are so accustomed to the philosophy of emergency that we use the mind and even the emotions principally in a crisis or in a situation which seems to demand some immediate action. As soon as this crisis is passed, we again drop back into purposeless thinking. As a result of this negative habit, it is obvious that most of our worldly affairs become confused, our path in life is indistinct, and we are without the support and strength of our own valid judgments. To meet this emergency, therefore, the concept of enlightened conduct was developed very long ago. The idea of it being that all conduct must have meaning. Now, it does not always have to have an overwhelming meaning. We may have concepts of enjoyment or rest or relaxation, but they must all fit into a broad over-concept. There is the story, of course, that when Solomon was building the temple in honor of his father David, he engaged the services of a very skillful and cunning workman. And this man, who was an architect, a builder, an ornamenter of the great structure, went each day into the Holy of Holies, or the most sacred part of that building. And there he received from God the commands for the work of the day. And he received a kind of plan, which was anciently called a trestle board in architecture, on which the design for the day's work was faithfully set forth. He then spent the day in fulfilling this plan, or advancing the building according to the will of God. Of course, this is an interesting symbolic report, for it tells us that in building our own temple, the temple of character, the temple of life, we must work from a divine plan, and we must have a certain inner communion with that plan. We must offer ourselves to the fulfillment of that plan. And the major works that we perform should be consistent with the grand purpose, which is the building of the temple of human character and happiness. Without such purpose, without such interludes of communion with the source of all purpose and all plan, the individual drifts. And in drifting, he becomes victim of all these different circumstances which arise from weakness or from indifference or from failure to have a clear insight as to the meaning of the things that he does. Now, in our discussion this morning, we want to take into consideration two aspects of conduct, which I have called in the subject of the morning, positive or active and passive. Now, active conduct bears upon the individual's relationships with the world around him. In activity, conduct moves from the person out into his environment, setting in motion causations, bringing about the harvesting of results. This motion of conduct into manifestation, therefore, causes the individual to appear as he is seen by others. It bestows upon him this thing we call temperament, which we may expect to have a certain consistent manifestation. The active phases of conduct, therefore, must include the organization of the life we are living. It must include the vision of the reason for the day's work. We are here with certain labor to perform, and almost always the labor of the day is in some way related to the labor of past days. We have brought projects to varying degrees of completeness. We have brought our own temperament and conduct to a certain level of integration. And from these foundations, we proceed to build further. And the work that is not finished today will be projected into the tomorrows that lie ahead. But there must be a relationship between yesterday and today. There must also be foundations established consciously and purposefully in order that tomorrow the building will proceed. Generally, we are indifferent to this pattern, but we must recognize the basic concept of a dependency between that which we do and the result that comes from action. The moment an action is set in motion, the individual to a degree loses control of it. It passes into a series of effect consequences. While the action is suspended, the effect is suspended. Once the action is performed, the effect also is released. Thus, all actions become the basis of further action. And in many instances, action today becomes only the basis of correction. We must tomorrow or the next day remedy the mistakes of today. Now, some mistakes are rather easily and cheerfully remedied. Others are not. And most of the more serious problems that we face arise from uncorrected mistakes or judgments basically so poor that correction becomes almost impossible once this action has been set in motion. Thus, in moving out into the world around us, we move into a precarious environment. We move into a situation fraught with dangers, with hazards, with complications. And the only way that we can cope with these difficulties is to plan our own action with the greatest of care. We are not careful in this respect. We have never trained ourselves to proceed in an orderly manner. Now, certain lines of thought, certain practices, sciences, and arts do give us a measure of discipline. And there are persons who have disciplined themselves successfully. They have reached a point in which they can depend reasonably well upon the clarity of their own pattern. These are the ones who move along with the greatest amount of security. Also, in their various occupations, they contribute the most to the general good, and usually in the end to their own good. If we have been subjected during life to some intense process of discipline. It may very well be that we have learned to use this power of our own consciousness. We have set certain regulations upon conduct, and these regulations prevent us from falling into excessive attitudes. Man has created around him in the world a structure of laws. These laws, which for the most part are unpopular, are nevertheless essential to the regulation of a society which has never learned to regulate itself. Thus, man has a certain measure of organization thrust upon him by the statutes and codes under which he lives. These codes punish him if he violates certain rules and principles. These codes are for the common protection of all men. And while at times they will work a hardship upon the individual, this situation cannot be remedied until man becomes a creature of obediences rather than a creature of disobediences. In the emphasis upon self-discipline, we also have, of course, the broad structure of education. Education as a method of discovering the truth may be uncertain and inadequate, but education as a method of subjecting to the young to discipline can have very valuable results. Even though the child begrudges its daily journey to school, begrudges the assignments and the homework, and feels very frustrated, especially in good weather, by the confining atmosphere of the classroom, he does learn to organize his own life. He learns to do things at certain hours and times, and he also begins the experience of those regular occupations, which must later take up the same time that he now expends in schooling. Thus, if he is an apt pupil or a fairly well-adjusted young person, he comes out of school prepared to work, able to set aside time and hour to the sacrifice of self-interest, to the necessities of life. If, however, he is unadjusted, schooling may fail him. In any event, however, it is this discipline factor which must be brought to the attention of the young that determines to a large measure the happiness and success of the later years of life. To assume this discipline, if it has not been conferred by circumstances, requires a personal activity of the will. The individual must settle down sometime, somewhere, and think this through for himself. Normally, he will not do this except in a matter of emergency. Only after his life has been a series of difficulties is he impelled or inclined to consider the possibility of correcting the tendencies in his own nature which have made these difficulties not only possible but inevitable. I've always been deeply impressed with the Buddhist doctrine of dependency. This is the doctrine that everything depends upon something that precedes it, that no action stands alone, and also that no action is without its own dependencies. This cycle of dependency we sometimes refer to as the law of cause and effect. We recognize this law not because man has made it, but because it is obvious everywhere in the operations of nature. We may rebel against natural law, but we can never win this rebellion. Law will ultimately grind us back into conformity, sometimes at very difficult cost to ourselves. Dependency means that where we are now is the inevitable result of something, that this something is not an accident or a mere unrelated incident. It is the unfolding of a way of life. The careless person, the thoughtless person, unfolds a way of life which becomes a monument to his carelessness and his thoughtlessness. and this monument must be like the cause which produced it. Therefore, carelessness results in carelessness, thoughtlessness in thoughtlessness. And so we go along until somewhere in this procedure, our weaknesses or our inadequacies catch up with us, and we come to some sorrowful and difficult emergency. This law of dependency also has a cheerful and more hopeful side. If man does cause order, he will enjoy order. There is no way in which he can escape either the good or that which is not good, resulting from himself. Whatever causes he sets in motion must inevitably bear their fruit. And our present state is unquestionably and undeniably the culmination of the factors of character and conduct which have preceded today, and which will, to a measure, continue to flow into tomorrow, unless at this moment, here and now, we make some valid change in the circumstances. Man, however, because he has the power of volitional action, or has a consciously directed will energy, is capable of breaking pattern. He is capable of breaking away from weakness. He is capable of correcting that which is not good. He is also capable of compromises, which will lead to further complications. Thus, at any moment, the individual does have control of himself, if he wishes to exert that control. But the moment that this instant passes, that which he has not controlled becomes part of the pressure upon which future things will depend. Thus, every moment that we permit our undirected or uncontrolled attitudes to influence conduct, in each of those moments we are creating new trouble. And this trouble will continue to accumulate until it becomes a heavy burden of suffering upon the soul of man. First, then, let us see how we could, in a reasonable way, affect the first or active phase of our conduct toward enlightenment. Enlightenment is a term which has been used in religion and philosophy, and to a measure in psychology, to signify a state of adequate internal awareness. The enlightened person is the person with insight, the person who possesses the power to judge value and to discover value. The enlightened person is therefore one who has come to certain decisions and has arrived at them through experience or insight, or perhaps both, and has come to the conclusion that certain things must be done. If his conclusions are correct, he is an enlightened person. This enlightenment is a dynamic, and many systems of comparative thought have pointed out that what the individual actually knows, he is almost certain to do. Thus, true knowledge, and in this case, true knowledge of enlightened conduct, must almost certainly produce action consistent with it. A person who wholeheartedly and wholesouledly knows a thing, believes a thing fully and completely, this person will act in accordance with that which he believes. How does it happen, then, that numerous persons with elegant and wonderful beliefs are apparently doing nothing, and more than that, are compromising or contradicting their own convictions at every step of life? Convinced that generosity is a virtue, they are selfish. Convinced that tolerance is desirable, they are intolerant. Convinced that broad-mindedness is desirable, they are narrow-minded. And also convinced that they live in a world ruled by law and order, they live an unlawful and disorderly existence. How does this happen? There can be only one answer to this kind of question, namely that the person claiming to know does not know. He is operating from the level of what he really knows. And what he really knows is not the same as that which he mentally claims to know. The reason that action can be inconsistent with credo is the fact that the credo is not known to be true. Now, how would we change this situation? It's hard to tell a person that he does not know that the golden rule is valuable. It is difficult to tell him that he does not know the integrity of the Sermon on the Mount. It is difficult for us to assume that this individual does not know the importance of the Ten Commandments. He knows these things. He has read about them. Perhaps he has been a faithful churchgoer for years and has heard them discussed repeatedly. If he has been confirmed into a religion, it is very likely that he has taken an obligation to obey these rules. He is well-intended, good-hearted, cheerfully accepting, but still he does not conduct himself according to these things which he holds to be sacred and right. To the average person, there can be no authority more important than the authority of God. There can be no question, therefore, that the admonitions have come from an inferior level, not likely to cause respect or acceptance. The individual cannot be convinced by logic if in his own mind, as a religious person, he is not convinced by the teachings of his faith or his belief. Thus, it is wrong to hold out the situation that if the individual was presented this information more forcibly, he would accept it. He cannot be presented with the information more forcibly than to have it revealed to him in the religion he holds to be true, the philosophy which he most definitely believes, the psychology to which he turns in time of trouble, or for that matter, from the world experience, which is founded in the great traditional patterns. Now, as an exception to this group, of course, we have the intellectual who perhaps is a skeptic on most subjects relating to religion. For him, perhaps, the problem is more difficult. But the majority of persons only wear their skepticism on the outer parts of their personalities. In emergencies, they go back again to the devotions and values which belong to their people. The reason, then, that the good instruction, the faithful ministry of great minds, the sacrifices of the teachers, the seers, the sages, and the saviors, the reason that these great messages, these great consolations of spirit, have not been able to change the course of the average person's life effectively is because the person does not actually accept them. He accepts them with his mind, he accepts them with his emotions, but he does not permit them to become the undisputed regulators of conduct. He has not experienced them as sovereign truth. He has accepted them merely as intellectual statements. Acceptance and memorization are not the same. We may remember the best and still practice the worst. The answer lies in the transformation or transmutation of a thing accepted mentally into a deeper and more important meaning directly applied to conduct. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, St. Paul tells us. And it is true that our good intentions are often shipwrecked by circumstances. Many individuals will say, if this was a different kind of a world, if people treated me differently, if I had more security around me, I would be able to practice more adequately the values which I believe within myself. This, of course, is a sense, an obvious statement, but again, it is not a true statement. If it were not for the difficulties around us, the problems that beset us, and the constant turmoil of our world, we would not need these internal instruments of validity in order to make life valuable. If we had no temptations, we could probably remain virtuous. If, however, we are unable to withstand the most immediate and instant temptation, our virtue is inadequate. There is no reason why we should insist that the temptation is the cause of our downfall. The cause lies not in the temptation, but the inability of ourselves to withstand it. Many persons tempted do not succumb. They have certain value. Now, this often means that in a large area of the personality, the individual does have certain adequate defenses. There is nearly always, however, in the person some area where his strength is not great enough. This area is almost always in an area of selfishness or self-interest. The individual can live a very noble doctrine as long as it doesn't cost him anything. But when it interferes with something he wants to do, when it interferes with the pressure of desire, when it interferes with the activity of his own opinion, he is likely to follow his own way and neglect those ways which are real and proper. Thus, in moving out from ourselves, the volitional energy which animates conduct and makes it possible for us to do things, this energy is not adequately directed by archetypal code. We do not have a clear vision of the world in which we live. We do not have a clear insight into the laws governing it. We may study these laws. We may memorize them. But if they have not become vital guides in conduct, we have not yet experienced them or known their true virtue in application to ourselves. Thus, we have a continuous struggle between the values which are gradually becoming known to us and the insistences of our own appetites. And in most cases, appetites win at least partially, with the result that results in themselves are inadequate at least partially. The problem then lies in attempting to frame some way of moving energy from within our own natures into action without violating the principle of right and wrong. This means, to a measure, that the person has to have a fairly solid support within his own nature. Nearly always, weakness arises also from a degree of ignorance. Ignorance is a very complicated word, one most people do not like to have applied to themselves. They always know someone else who is ignorant, but their own peculiar inconsistencies are not ignorance. They are sort of a divine right contrary to the laws governing everyone else. This is not always highly demonstrable, but most satisfactory as long as we do not attempt to apply it. Actually, then, this ignorance has limited us in our appreciation of value. Ignorance makes the universe seem small. It makes the laws of nature seem unimportant. Ignorance clouds all value. Ignorance deprives us of constant experience and example insight. The person who lives in a state of ignorance is unable, therefore, to build up his own recognition of the values in the world he lives in. The ignorant person, for example, lacking scientific knowledge, lacks the scientific key to the operation of the entire universal process. One thing a scientist generally does acknowledge, namely, that whatever be the principles, energies, powers, or beings at the root of life, life is orderly. That laws are immutable, and that science advances by obedience and not by disobedience. The scientist has found a world of exactitudes. The average ignorant person is unaware of a world of exactitudes. They live in a world of passing things. Again, ignorance of art will cause the average person to be deficient in his understanding of the laws regulating beauty. He is therefore deprived of the understanding of those laws operating within himself to make his life beautiful. The person who is completely deficient in music not only fails to recognize the vast harmonic pattern of the universe, but is unable to cultivate the harmonies of his own life. Thus, various arts and sciences in all areas contribute ultimately to the recognition that our world, this sphere we inhabit, is a magnificent, purposed instrument, that it is a wonderful thing rooted in laws, and that these laws are its security and the security of every creature inhabiting this world. If, however, we are unaware of all this vast area of knowledge, if we are unaware of the law of cause and effect operating in history, if we are unaware of the principles of dependency revealed in economics, if we are unaware of the patterns governing conduct as represented in legislation and in law, in jurisprudence, if we are unaware of all these principles which men have identified and upon which they have built great systems of learning, if we have no concept of these important values, then we are unable to control or regulate our own lives with full confidence. Thus, ignorance is not so much that we are deprived of a particular art or science. Rather, we are deprived of a window looking into universals by which we might be able to perceive more adequately the rules and patterns operating everywhere in life. Thus, ignorance, in a sense, weakens us by locking away from our attention things which, if seen and understood, would alter our lives. And knowledge is always to be considered as that form of gradually increasing insight by which we become more and more aware of the things as they are and the need of our own adjustment with them. If we can, therefore, have a somewhat larger personal insight, if life has brought us into contact with forms of knowledge that are valuable to us, these should contribute something to the recognition of a lawful universe. The person who has formed a successful business realizes that he had to build according to law, that he had to follow rules and patterns, that he had to derive insight and understanding at first perhaps from other organizations that had succeeded in a similar field. But ultimately his problem became highly individual, and his success ultimately depended upon his judgment. Judgment trained by experience, by observation, by reflection, by experimentation, and by recourse to the traditions governing the thing he is doing. It should seem, therefore, that a person, by experiencing the operations of these laws, can scarcely fail to be moved to a kind of conscious acceptance. It is difficult to imagine that a person who has learned the laws governing the management of a vast industry should be totally ignorant of the laws applying to the management of his own family, to his own personal conduct, or to those most immediately dependent upon him in the various relationships of life. To be able to run a business well and have wayward children is a very peculiar contradiction. Yet it is not an uncommon thing to find in life, because we have not learned to transfer patterns. We have not learned this law of analogy by which we can apply principles known in one thing to the operations of another thing. We have isolated various ideas, prevented them from making a total contribution, limiting them to some special endeavor, and not recognizing that the laws governing one endeavor reveal to us the lawfulness of the pattern underlying nearly all endeavor. To be thoughtful in these points is therefore to have a certain victory of our own consciousness or our own conduct over the circumstances which had previously tormented or annoyed us. If then it is true that experience will demonstrate to us not only the lawfulness of a world pattern, but the need for a personal pattern, if this can be brought home to our attention, then we probably discover that we are in great need of instruction, help, guidance in the integration of this neglected area of ourselves. So in our enthusiasm to get something done quickly, with the modern tendency toward the efficiency complex, we dash madly to someone for help. We wish someone to help us to arrange our lives, to reveal to us that which is necessary. We go to an analyst to have our character analyzed. We've been living with it for 60 years, but we have to have someone else tell us what it is. We are convinced by this time that we have so hypnotized ourselves that we are unable to recognize our own mistakes, and this is largely the case. So we go to this analyst and pass through the humiliating experience of having our so-called well-adapted personality torn to shreds, to discover that actually our entire life has been built upon the fact that we were spanked too young. This situation may therefore result in a tyranny of circumstances affecting our success and failure for the next 3.5 score of years. Thus the real source of much of our conduct is so dim, so uncertain, and in its own nature so unreasonable that it is utterly ridiculous. But we do not even realize this. Often by the time we go under analysis, we are in a pressing difficulty. The house of cards that we stacked together so promiscuously has fallen apart. We are in that highly receptive state of failure, which is about the only condition an individual can be in and admit that he needs anything. In this condition, then, the emergencies have already taken a heavy toll upon our abilities and our energies. We perhaps at that moment are in a definite need of help and willing to accept it. But when the help comes, or when we do a great deal of thinking about it, we are in another emergency. And this emergency is, can the average person sustain with dignity the sudden discovery that he has been a mess for 50 years, that everything he has been done badly, that he is responsible for the innumerable conditions which he has blamed on others, and that, largely speaking, he has wasted the best years of a very good life, that he has been wrong from the beginning, And it was only his own intensity of energy which managed to carry him along until in older years the intensity lessened and suddenly the emergency confronted him. And he no longer had any resources, physical or psychological, with which to combat this emergency. It is true that many persons in older years are unable to make this adjustment adequately. I've known a great many cases of older persons who have simply declined to consider the situation on the ground that it will be more comfortable to die as they are than to change in years when practical result of changing will not be very great. The attitude, of course, is wrong, that the person is able to improve as long as he is able to breathe, and it is far more important that he does improve. It may be that it is also certain that he cannot completely restore the life he has wasted. But there's no reason why he should waste another 5 or 10 years and be that much worse off. The only reason he can do this successfully is his own inner consciousness does not conceive of the fact that there is anything beyond this life which might possibly appear as a factor in this compound. He believes in immortality. He is certain that when he leaves this world, he will rest in Abraham's bosom. At the same time, it does not occur to him to make any correction here and now because it's too late. Yet the good book tells us that the departure of man from this world is the beginning of an eternal existence. But in his acting, the departure from this world is the end. And it is too late to do anything about eternal existence. Must be awfully late. This problem also presents other situations. Supposing the individual looking back over a long life, rather selfishly spent, imagines in some small cellular area of the brain that he must face in the universe some accounting for his conduct. Perhaps the desolating thought of immortality is true. Perhaps also this individual, having certain training in that direction, believes that the universe beyond consists of punishment and reward. That in this other lifeness which opens ahead of him in the not too distant future, things are going to be weighed and measured according to facts. If so, is it too late at any time while we are here to try to put these facts in order? Also, can it ever be too soon? This is a very moot question. The young put it off for aged years. The aged put it off because the grave may end the emergency. Now, the materialist has some consolation in this thought, but there are so many other things about his beliefs that are not consoling that this is scarcely to be regarded as compensation. Actually, the individual has no belief in anything if he is not anxious to improve the first moment he recognizes the need. If he does not carry through this impulse, he simply has no belief. He is taking the long chance that in some mysterious way he is going to fall on his feet, either in this world or the world beyond. But he has no just reason to assume this to be true. He is simply optimistic, or like the small child, is convinced that the parent's punishment cannot be too severe. This type of thinking makes, again, for confusion in immediate conduct. And where this confusion continues, the conduct produces more and more misfortune. Another interesting situation that arises in many of these problems is that the individual, having certain wrong ideas, upon which he has perhaps built a very fanciful and inadequate life, is able to hold the belief in these wrong ideas, perhaps for his entire earthly span. One of the reasons why he is able to hold on to error and not discover that he is wrong is the cautious and careful manner in which he administers his own knowledge. The individual has a certain internal defense structure. Very few people are willing to submit their unformed opinions to any clear criteria. Most simple statement is that the individual holding certain beliefs is careful not to apply them, especially in areas which he has every reason to believe will reveal the inadequacy of these ideas. Thus, we have a series of inward convictions which we carefully suspend and isolate. We will not test them. We will not trust our own weight upon them. For something inside tells us that they are not right or not adequate. So we remain theorists. We talk about everything. We think about everything. We give the most sage advice to innumerable persons, at the same time praying in our hearts that they won't follow the advice. Because if they follow the advice and they come to trouble, then we will be to blame. Thus, we do not want to open ourselves to this kind of blame. Furthermore, we do not want to get into the condition in which we blame ourselves for our own action. This is humiliating. And rather than subject ourselves to this, we simply either evade action or refuse to accept consequences. There are a great many things that the individual does for which he has ready excuses. These excuses are not reasons. They are not factual, but the individual manages to sell them to himself. Thus, by continuously excusing his own conduct, or continuously attempting to transfer the cause of his trouble from himself to someone else, he is able to maintain an attitude of innocence down through the years. But this innocence finally falls apart also, because the person cannot deceive himself indefinitely. The facts are always there, and sometime these facts will assert themselves. And there is nothing that we can do to prevent this. It means then, for practical purposes, that in problems of conduct, we must begin, in the active aspect of conduct, to censor or guide or direct or give certain thoughtful attention to the impulses that flow from within ourselves. These impulses are nearly always stimulated by some external circumstance. An individual does something, we rise to this challenge. Another individual wants something, we react to their desire. Thus, the stimulation of a large part of activity comes from the pressure of circumstances, particularly the pressure of a tight spot, which causes us to immediately bring all available resources to bear to extricate ourselves. If we merely release patterns or energies because of the challenge of externals, each incident stands alone. Tomorrow it is one problem, the next day it is another. Each one we meet according to the emergency of the moment. And for lack of pattern, one solution contradicts another, And in time, we find that we have accomplished very little by these inadequate, fragmentary decisions. There has to be a reason. There has to be a purpose, or the thing that is done will not be adequate. The only way that we can arrive at purpose concerning objective action is to determine the reason for self. Why are we here? What are we here to do? What is the long-range strategy of our life? In what way do our plans turn or move? Why are we performing any action at all? Is action merely for the sake of food and clothing and shelter? Is action merely some possible way of paying the bills of today while we contract the bills of tomorrow and try to escape the creditor who presents the bills of yesterday? What is the strategy behind life? Are we here for any purpose that we know? This, in many instances, brings a rather negative reaction. The average person cannot state a clear purpose. If he is able to state it at all, it is inadequate. It is merely a purpose resulting from the acceptances of the pressure of responsibilities. He is purposed, yes. He is working because he wishes to be a respectable member of society. Or he is working in order that he may gain sufficient means to have leisure in his advanced years. Or he is struggling along from day to day until he can collect his old age pension. These problems represent purpose. Another man's purpose is to send his children to college. Still another one's purpose is to try to keep his children out of jail. Still another person's purpose is to establish some kind of a status. He wishes to outshine his neighbors. He wants a larger and deeper swimming pool than any other one in the neighborhood. For this he will struggle, sacrifice, live, and die. Now these various purposes, of course, can be attained. And we can adapt our energies to these ends. We can do it so completely that we can have the largest swimming pool in the neighborhood. We can do it with such efficiency and intensity that we can ascend the ladder of status to a certain degree. We can go as high as our capacities will sustain us. But with this type of purposing behind us, we lack one of the most essential principles, and that's moral directive. Unless the purpose is meaningful, truly meaningful, it does not bring into focus the more meaningful parts of our own natures. It may well be that the conscientious businessman makes a code of honor, that he resolves that he will not achieve unless he can do so honestly. This honor and honesty constitute moral virtues. But these do not exhaust the moral needs of man. These needs go further and deeper. Action, in its long scheme of things, cannot be merely mechanistic. Most of the ends to which we apply energy today are purely physical. Most of our activities, mental and emotional, are on the level of the physical or the appetitive part of our own natures. Thus we deprive ourselves of the more luminous values of internal consciousness. The purpose of true consciousness is to know, is to grow, is to unfold the potential that is within us. That type of progress in life which does not imply any need for the increase of internal understanding is not adequate to a human being and must result in dissatisfaction, contention, and despair at some time in life. Pattern, therefore, is growth through experience. By having the largest swimming pool, we may learn something. We may possibly learn that a smaller pool is more satisfactory. But whatever we learn comes as the result of experience. This learning, in turn, must become part of our inner life. It must enrich the motivations by which we are impelled to action. Therefore, it is learning through experience that helps us to mature the activity of our own beings, our will becoming moved toward activity must pass through the censorship of our thoughts and emotions. If our minds are ennobled and our emotions are enriched, we are going to be impelled to a better level of personal conduct on the active side of life. The more we have in us, the more that can come out. The deeper and broader our inward consciousness, the more mature our material conduct will be. And it is only maturity of conduct that can protect us from the tragedies resulting from immaturity of conduct. Our troubles arise from our own inability to function on a mature level of thought and emotion. There is no answer to this except the improvement, the maturing of these parts of our own psychic lives. Maturity is enrichment. Maturity is the individual coming into the contact of that with that which is better. Maturity is the continuous bringing of experience into the inner parts of life, so that the mind and the emotions are enriched by thoughtfulness and contemplation about the results of conduct. Thoughtlessness denies all this. The individual caught in the web that threatens thoughtfulness may escape by road of some barbiturate of one kind or another. Thoughtfulness in most people produces a headache. A headache in most instances requires aspirin. And if you believe your television, there are several forms of this, some of which are practically a doctor's prescription. So you may have your choice. But perhaps some people need their headaches more than anything else that happens to them, especially if this headache is a symbol of a struggle to think. If you have first used a muscle that has been idle for many years, it will ache considerably. The person who has allowed himself to get out of physical condition and suddenly using stressful exercise may be quite ill as a result. But unless we pass through this process of reestablishing muscle tone, we must remain physical weaklings. And the discomfort is compensated for by the ultimate achievement of that which is desired. The same way in thinking. Thinking is very painful in its early stages. In fact, it has discouraged innumerable persons at the beginning. However, if we work with it carefully over a period of time, we can develop what someone has called the thinking muscle until it does things for us the way we want them done. The mind becomes active and available. And because it is active and available, there will be fewer headaches. For most headaches arise from stress, or strain, or tension, or worry, or fear. And these are not so likely to afflict the truly thoughtful, intelligent person. So by gradually strengthening the resources of our own mental-emotional equipment, we live better. We are more thoughtful by instinct rather than by desperate effort. It does not require a great effort for a thoughtful person to be thoughtful. But for a thoughtless person to become suddenly thoughtful requires not only a completely superhuman effort, but is factually impossible. Therefore, we have to grow into these attainments which we desire. Now, the second and contrary phase of our problem deals with what we might term, I've called, the passive phase of conduct. Now, the passive phase of conduct deals with that aspect by which we handle what comes into us from the outside. In this case, we are not going out like some knight errant conquering and to conquer. We are also confronted continuously with emergencies that move in upon us, emergencies that move in upon our thinking, upon our emotions. We must handle that which happens to us. Now, in many instances, what happens is simply the result of what we have done. But regardless of the detail involved, whether we wish to accept this or not, we must cope with what arises. It's possible that the delinquent child is the result of our own failure to correct and direct that child. But when it becomes a delinquent faculty in ourselves, which has been neglected or improperly cultured, the result has to be endured. So we have certain things moving in on us continuously. A series of passive acceptances. The universe moves in upon us. It moves in on us in many ways. In some ways, we are aware of this motion. We have certain cognition of it. In other ways, we have no awareness of what is happening, until perhaps a very large pattern of circumstances has built up. One common problem, of course, is our adjustment to those phases of universal existence which we cannot change. In a certain limited area of symbolism, man has recognized the need for obedience and practices it. For example, we are all subject to seasons. Winter and spring and summer and fall, and we may as well adjust to them. If we do not like the particular climate where we live, we can try another. But as we go along through life, we discover that the perfect climate lies only in our own souls, and that wherever we go, it will either be too hot or too cold, too dry or too wet, or something will happen. A man who found out that there was a certain place in the world where the temperature never varies over 5 degrees from 70. He said, "This is where I want to live." He came back shortly after, rather disillusioned, because he said the book had failed to point out to him that the temperature was correct, but that the annual precipitation was 350 inches. Therefore, he only saw the sun on very rare occasions and lived in a condition of perpetual dampness. So climates and all these things, men have to adjust to. And we do adjust to them. And sometimes we wonder how other people adjust to some that they like. It's a little difficult to find an individual longing, yearning year after year to get back to the splendid atmosphere of Death Valley. This is a little hard for us to understand, but there are people who would rather be there than anywhere else on earth. And under the existing conditions, I see no reason why they should not be allowed to be there. But we do adjust. We adjust to day and night. We adjust to the natural motion of elements. We adjust to the flowing of the river through our city, or to the ocean that laps upon the shores of our coasts. We adapt ourselves to storms and rain and lightning and earthquakes because we have to. And in this area of adaptation, we must build whatever defenses and supports that we can to protect ourselves insofar as we are able to do so from situations that in their fullest expression are beyond our control. So we gradually build our defenses against that which we cannot cope with. We build them as best we can, entirely certain that all of our defenses will be inadequate, but they will help. We adjust ourselves also to many problems of daily existence. We adjust ourselves to the need of food, shelter, and rest. In an economic system, we adjust ourselves to the need of independent means or to the various problems of earning that which is required. So we do have certain acceptances. And these acceptances are, for the most part, not especially painful. We do not get too excited over the weather. We talk about it all the time. But as Mark Twain said, we never do anything about it. But we do have a measure of true acceptance. In the passive phase of our own enlightened conduct, we must also recognize the importance of being able to accept without stress or strain. The moment anything that happens to us is viewed from an enlightened internal relationship, most of the misfortune or dismal circumstance is removed from the incident. For example, if everything in life becomes meaningful, meaning takes preferment over pleasant or unpleasant. A thing which brings to us the knowledge that we want is always worth what we have to pay for it. The individual who wants to have his better status home must carry the heavy financial worries and problems attendant upon this level of living. He may feel that it is perfectly fair bargain, that he is perfectly willing to worry himself to death for 50 years in order to live better than his neighbor. If that is his decision, that is his decision. We are quite willing to earn most things, but we like to think of payment as being a kind of coinage that we can spend as we wish to, not as we should. Now, this other kind of coinage that arises from experience is not so easily expendable on trivia. Therefore, we are not so much interested in it. But it is also definitely true that much of the bite can be taken out of misfortune if the person recognizes its educational value. If, when something goes wrong, the individual takes this circumstance, analyzes it, considers it fairly in terms of value, contemplates the mistakes which he made by which this situation was made possible, estimates the true relationship between his own selfishness and the fact that someone imposed upon him, if he studies these things carefully as the result of a crisis, he is liable to gain from this crisis a priceless enlightenment, which will ensure him a far happier and better life in the future. If he is willing to pay all that he makes for 50 years to maintain status, he should be willing to pay something for information that will ultimately bestow peace of soul, peace of mind, strength of understanding. These two are also valuable. They are just as valuable as the status symbols which he seeks to accumulate. There is nothing more valuable to the individual than the power to live happily with himself. And his ability to live happily with anyone else depends upon this. So whatever the price may be, a circumstance may well be worth its cost if it produces insight, if it adds up to an increasing power to handle circumstances. An experience or a problem only remains valueless if the individual rejects its value. If when something goes wrong, we simply turn and accuse someone else, then we have rejected value. If when something goes wrong, we excuse it in terms of the times in which we live, the prevailing problems of the day, or that perhaps we were somewhat deceived in this thing, when we settle down to the neat problem of excusing ourselves, what have we done? We have paid a heavy price for experience and then never collected. We have bought something and never allowed it to be delivered to us. We have paid the bill, but we do not have the product. Now, this is an extravagance that very few people can afford. When you buy something, you expect to get it, and you hope that it's going to have a guarantee on it. But if we take any experience in life, and having suffered or endured or merely lived for a long time, and out of all of this has come nothing but the conviction that the world is a terrible place and that we were born to suffer and that everyone else in the world has picked on us and that we have tried so very hard and have always been misunderstood, when these are the types of convictions that arise from living, we have simply failed to receive the goods we bought and paid for. We have lived to gain something, and we have gained nothing. Because it makes no difference how much we prove the other person is wrong. This will never bring to us any additional personal experience of consciousness. Perhaps we have pretty good evidence that the other person was wrong. But this is not where the emphasis must be. A person who is wrong seldom accomplishes the magnitude of his own wrong without some help from somebody. And the person who has wronged us could scarcely have achieved this neat accomplishment unless we had contributed to it ourselves. And it is our little contribution that should be our principal concern. I remember a man came to me who was very unhappy because he had been cheated out of about $25,000. In the course of the conversation, he told me that he had made what he considered to be a very exceptional investment that had then gone exceptionally sour. What was the investment? He had decided that the best investment a man can make now is one that pays the largest returns. This is his first mistake. The second one was that he really believed that he could make 25% per annum on second mortgages and trust deeds. The company got his money and folded. The reason it got his money is because he wanted an unreasonable return on his investment. He wanted the kind of usury that he would scream if anyone did this to him. He would never borrow money from the company in which he had invested. He had simply cheated himself by believing something that was unreasonable, unfair, and dishonest. Yet he is perfectly willing to consider that the other person is totally to blame. The whole problem in suffering and problem lies in this dimension. In one way or another, we must contribute to our own misery or we cannot be miserable. And our important job always is to find out what we contributed, rather than to try to evade this responsibility by insisting that the other person has injured us. If we can find out our own mistake, any problem is worth its cost. And in life, these problems follow each other in certain regular insistency. But it is obvious and factual that the individual who has a reasonably developed internal understanding of value has fewer problems than the person who does not have this understanding. Problems belong to levels, and the worst problems are for those who think badly. If then we are able to accept what we observe, if we are enabled to have what I call here a certain passive side of enlightened conduct. What is this passiveness? It is the ability to accept without creating an intense defense mechanism against the truth. To be open inside to the facts that we need. To accept these facts, not as a calamity, but as the natural effect of causes, and to immediately endeavor to so improve from our newer understanding of these facts that we will not make the same mistake again. Actually, with most persons, mistakes fall in very small pattern groups. Many individuals make exactly or almost exactly the same mistake 100 times in the course of a life. This is not an exaggeration, because a certain attitude that is not sound, being applied constantly through the years to every condition that arises, will result in each condition going sour. Such persons believe that they are peculiarly plagued by the gods. They are not. They are simply the victim of an attitude which is basically incorrect. At any moment they realize this, they can release themselves from this vicious circle of inevitable consequences. Most individuals are not original enough to work out any very interesting or remarkable mistakes. The mistakes are exceedingly mediocre, rather commonplace, and mostly dull. They are just the good old-fashioned mistakes that have been recorded in history since the beginning of time. There is therefore nothing particularly remarkable that we have to watch for, nor does it take a highly skillful intellectual to estimate these mistakes. Anyone who can make them has intelligence enough to stop doing it. It does not require total wisdom to correct the average person's mistakes. He hasn't made the big ones yet. He will not make them until he has far more skill than he has now. His mistakes are rather small and for the most part elementary. But he can suffer from them nevertheless. But within each person is the ability to do the next thing that he must do in order to grow. Nature has bestowed upon all creatures a kind of aura of futurity. The individual can move into the next state for himself with comparatively little pressure or need for adjustment. All that is necessary is the simple impulse to move rather than to become static. The individual who is static, of course, closes himself against the changing of his own personality to meet his own problems. This is a sad thing in itself. Only the person who becomes crystallized, mentally or emotionally, is willing to continue to make the same mistake indefinitely. Or else perhaps he has been so badly conditioned that he does not have any insight at all into the fact that what happens to him bears any relationship to what he himself does. Such a condition is a very advanced condition of ignorance or lack of adjustment or lack of integration. So we have this passive phase now, the ability to be quiet, be organized, be reasonably impersonal, and to allow experience to present its many faces to us, and at the same time not create a quick defense against truth. If we defend ourselves against truth, we have very little hope of peace in this world or anywhere else. And the defense against truth is simply the defense of egoism. It is the individual who prefers to assume that he is right and the universe is wrong. He may assume this, but he can never prove it. But ultimately, nature will disprove it. So the more quickly we accept the sovereignty of law, the more quickly we will begin to relieve ourselves of pressure and tension. For the philosophically minded, the religiously minded, the law of cause and effect is probably one of the most important concepts to be brought home into the life of the person. This law is a very simple statement. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. Whatever we do will return to us. Whatever attitudes we hold that are right will be rewarded. They will be rewarded not by an outside power, but by the operation of their own intrinsic rightness. All attitudes that we hold that are wrong are of their own nature indefensible. And that which results from them must be wrong. And this wrong will perpetuate itself until the basic attitude is corrected. The individual who is wrong will always suffer. The only solution to suffering is therefore the correction of the wrongness in our own attitude, thought, emotion, or conduct. When we do that which is right, in the way in which it should be done, the rightness in it will bring its own natural reward. The reward of rightness is adjustment. The reward of right acceptances will be that the individual is in harmony with the pattern for himself. The moment this internal harmony is established, it is easier and almost inevitable to assume that the exterior situation will move into consistency with it. A person who truly loves in his own heart is not going to hate in his thoughts or emotions. An individual who is honorable inside is not going to perform dishonorable actions. The reason he can perform the dishonorable action is that his own internal rightness has not been achieved. Many people believe that a code of self-discipline is a frustrating one, that it will lead to lack of social progress. This is, of course, totally untrue. For without integration within the individual, there can be no progress. There can only be a perpetuation of confusion, as we see it in our world and world affairs today. The things that are happening are not progress unless they are leading in some direction. And if that direction itself is not constructive, then the actions are not progressive. If then we are really concerned with this, our problem is always to be receptive to fact, choosing to so instruct ourselves that we can work with fact, that we can use the fact of a thing as the basis of a new confidence in ourselves about the lawfulness of the world in which we live. A fact is not cold or dead. A fact is simply a form of truth. To abide with truth is to live. To depart from truth is to perish. And the discovery of truth, as we need to know it, and to the degree that it is necessary to us, this discovery is the principal purpose of life. The reward of finding it early is a long and peaceful life, but it must be discovered, for it is the true cause of enlightened conduct. And enlightened conduct itself is twofold. It is that we shall so conduct ourselves in the world that we shall have the natural admiration and respect of others, and so conduct ourselves within ourselves that our natures are constantly open to improvement. That there is no dogmatism, there is no criticism, no condemnation, by means of which we lock consciousness against experience. So if we are relaxed in our relation to the world, simply permitting the facts to lead, we shall usually come out rather well. If we are also relaxed in ourselves, permitting the facts to reveal their own natures and escape from our determination to interpret facts to justify ourselves, we will naturally have a stronger interior resource with which to meet the problems of the day. Now, it's not assumed that we're going to make these grand achievements all in one moment. But there is no reason why each person cannot take a few minutes of his time, especially in moments when there is stress, to sit down quietly and think some of these things through reasonably. Realizing that if he does not do so, his opinions will destroy him. He cannot escape. Man cannot bluff in nature. Nature alone holds all the cards all the time. Man cannot outwit nature. Man cannot refute that which nature proclaims. Man cannot vary the laws of the universe. He is only a mote in a sunbeam, and these laws extend beyond the furthest galaxy in space. Man cannot absorb the infinite purpose and move it to his own desire. But man can make a constructive adjustment with realities, by means of which they contribute to his maintenance because he has kept their rules. And any person who is in trouble has in some way broken these rules. We all break them. But when we break them, it comes to be a very good thing to be thoughtful about it. Try to put the situation in order. Try to find the value and build upon it. If we will therefore outwardly act constructively and inwardly remain continually available for experience, so that we can impersonally and impartially weigh things and cling unto that which is good, if we can achieve these two basic purposes, even to a slight degree, life will improve. And as we improve in these procedures, life will become steadily more desirable, more valuable to us, and we shall begin to understand that real status is that dignity, that natural aristocracy, which arises through total obedience to the universal purpose. For the truly great person is the one who has learned to obey the law, to live according to it, and to permit its continual unfoldment to occur within himself, so that he is constantly in motion, moving toward truth. Such a career represents the highest attainment of mortal man in this sphere in which he lives. Done? Now I'd like to call to your attention our subject for next Sunday morning, which will incidentally be the first time for many years in which we've held an Easter Sunday service. So our subject will be From the Crucifixion to the Resurrection, the study of the early Christian mysticism relating to the story of Christ in the world of the dead, or as a church calls it, Christ in limbo, during those days between the crucifixion and the resurrection. There's a very interesting mysticism involved in this, and I have not noted that, as far as I can learn, that anyone has done much with this subject in many, many years, so that we're going to do what we can. I'd like to also announce that on Wednesday, March 29th at 8 p.m., our friend Dr. Framrose Bode is going to give a talk on Indian culture through the ages, illustrated with films prepared by the government of India and which are loaned to Dr. Bode for this occasion. I have a little note here as to what some of the films will be about, and there is something for everyone. Here is the films will include art, architecture, the Indian dance and music, and here's one for you all, feminine fashions. Now, what could be more desirable? Incidentally, I think there might be a good point here, for I'm not particularly overwhelmed with Western fashions this season. And perhaps something of real grace and dignity will appear here as a panacea for the Parisian product, which is getting to be quite a bore. So we hope that you will be interested in this phase of the subject. I'd like to also call attention to the fact that the Birthday Club, which is one of the groups that is assisting our activities here with the library and building, of the Birthday Club is holding a Zodiac party this afternoon, honoring the sign of Pisces. Well, of course, that's a very honorable sign, as Milton says, for I am in it. So, anyway, the luncheon is going to be at 1:30, and a program will follow. Ask in the lobby for the North Hollywood address of the hostess, Miss Betty Berry, and for a ride if you happen to need transportation. Perhaps even if you're not so much interested in the birthday party, you will enjoy the ride. Who knows? So anyway, if you need transportation, friends will try to help you to have it. I might add that after next Sunday, I'm going to Portland for 2 weeks. And if you have friends there, if you will let us have their names and addresses, we will be glad to send them programs. Also, we might mention in connection with the morning lecture our discussion in print, which you can secure at the table, Vital Concepts of Personal Growth. We think this would help. Also, our book, Self-Unfoldment. And as I say, don't forget Dr. Bode's discussion on Wednesday evening. And if your names are not on our mailing list, will you be so kind as to let us have them? This will be the last week in which the Egyptian exhibit will be in the library. Beginning next week, there will be an exhibit of Bibles, Bible leaves, and other material appropriate to the Easter season. So that if you're interested in the Egyptian material, we hope you'll take a look at it this Sunday, as this is the last week it will be available.
The remaining part of this lecture is at a higher volume level.
Thank you very much for being with us, and we hope to see you next week.